Isaiah chapter 30. Verse 20. And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not thy teachers be removed into a corner anymore. But thine eyes shall see thy teachers, and thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it. Now, most people listen in such a way that I'm halfway through the first verse before it dawns on them this might be a message from God's book for them. As I said last Sunday, it's impossible that this nationwide and worldwide audience has not been touched by the atrocities in New York, Washington, and the attempt over Pennsylvania. And lots of people are knocked off kilter with the shock of what has happened. Well, God's Word always has a message for us. So listen as I read it again. And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. Now, am I saying that God gives these things? I wish God would smite some of these preachers with dumbness, other than what already resides in their cranium. Frothing at the mouth about the judgment coming on the United States because of our sins and because of that and because of this. Why don't they just shut up? I had the same reaction when preachers were harping that AIDS was God's judgment on the homosexuals. If God judged evil, he would turn some of these preachers into monkeys. AIDS began in the most heterosexual society on the earth, Zaire. This is not the judgment of God on the United States for its sins. This is a bunch of idiot, evil bastards. illegitimate sons of Islam. That in the words of our president, and I admire him for saying it, blaspheme the meaning of Islam, which shares the same consonants in that Semitic root language as shalom. Same three consonants. The Hebrew word shalom, shem, lamek, and mem. Same three letters are at the basis of Islam, Islam, which means peace. Now, I want no one to get the idea that because I have led us through the book of Romans and have just touched and began to teach in Romans 2:1, on judge not, for when you wherein you judge, you take the place of God, as I have been teaching, and presume a position to which you are not entitled. And that is to habitually elevate yourself in self-righteousness and presume the right to determine by your judgment what somebody's standing before God is. You know, an analogous thought that I can weave in here is, I know a lot of preachers that refuse to preach a funeral for a suicide victim because of their limited intelligence, judgmental attitude that no murderers go to heaven. And only God can take a life. And this person took his own life. And therefore he's going to hell. And therefore I can't be of any comfort or any help at the funeral. And I won't preach the funeral because he's damned. Nobody knows what happens in those milliseconds. Those milliseconds between the act, whatever the cause, and the last breath of life on this earth. Nobody dares state the ultimate place of anyone save God. And I have been teaching you that that word to judge, shapat, is used synonymously with sedek, which is a relationship word to judge, and sedek, the righteousness Hebrew root word. And hasar, which is love. God, who in the picture of the high priest with the breastplate of righteousness, really the breastplate of judgment on his heart, judges with righteousness, judges with the capacity to know the inside of a person as well as the outside, and judges with love, and judges with the right to forgive anybody because he already paid the price for the whole world. The judgment we're talking about is a habitual attitude of, I'm ahead of where I would have gone had I stayed in Romans, and I'm leaving it quickly today. The judgment is a habitual attitude of putting yourself in the place of God regarding eternal standing. How ridiculous to think you can't have an opinion when you confront evil. You're going to surprise a pedophile in the kindergarten and say, "God bless you, sir." You're going to pray for the Lord to forgive Satan. Some people are so spiritual they make me sick by their definition of spirituality. They would not be caught dead saying, "God damn the devil." Well, Michael the archangel did. When he wrestled, Jude says, when he wrestles with the devil over the body of Moses on Mount Nebo, he would not rebuke Satan to his face because Satan still occupied a position because of Adam's default, and there's no question about how evil Satan was. He didn't put himself in the place of God, even though he was Michael the archangel. He didn't say, "You filthy, low down." See, he's better than I am. I say that once in a while. He didn't say, indeed, I quote Jude, he would not rebuke him personally. He said, "God damn you, devil." Oh, no, he didn't. Naughty, naughty, dirty, dirty. Yes, he did. He said, "The Lord rebuke you. The Lord rebuke you. Your day's coming. And God damn you. I can't, but he will. I can't, but he will." But there are judgments to be made on this earth that require the tension of doing what Romans 2 says we should not do habitually from the position of having looked at the sins of Romans 1 and pulling ourselves up in some superior stature and putting ourselves in the place of God and judging them. Because as you will see when I turn to Romans 2, you do the same things. And as Matthew 7 says, the measure you eke out in judgment is the measure that will come to you. But that doesn't mean that you can't have intelligent discernment. There is a gift of the Spirit called discerning of spirits, the same word, same root, krino, and its derivatives. The Holy Spirit in us, as one of His expressions in the nine gifts of the Spirit, is the gift of discerning of spirits, krino, same word we're told not to be doing in the context of Romans 2, and that's not my message today. I'll continue with Romans 2 in detail. I just want to jump ahead to say, you don't take the krino apparatus out of your head. You don't stop being human. You don't stop having evaluative judgments based upon sound facts. You just don't be so quick self-righteously to hide behind a cloak called hypocrisy. Hypocrisy, the word comes from a mask worn in the Greek drama where the actor hid behind a mask and hid his own identity while he put the congregation or the crowd down. Don't sit there judging habitually, putting yourself in the place of God when you don't have His capacities. And I got a ring in my microphone again. You don't have His capacities. But there's still some krino that's allowed. Paul to the Corinthians, same writer, 4th, 5th, and 6th chapters, coming out of the 3rd, spends a lot of time He tells them of a previous letter that he had written, because there's actually four letters that he wrote to the Corinthian church, of which we have two. And he references a previous letter that he had written them, in which he rebuked them for something that they were letting go on in the congregation. And they, further references in Corinthians indicate, had written back to him, justifying and explaining what he had rebuked. And the first Corinthian letter you have in your Bible is the response to their explanation and excuses for his prior rebuke in a first letter that we don't have. Paul just references it. And their response to his rebuke is to judge Paul. Their spiritual father, the apostle and pastor of that church who built it. And he began to argue, and I have a reference point for this to today's message. He begins to argue with them, resenting the argument. He is God's slave, God's servant, as they are God's slaves and God's servants. But he, as the domata, gifted to the church, under shepherd, is God's instrument directing God's slaves, and he never forgets that he is directing that which is the property of the Lord, who bought it with his own blood. And they better not forget that he is the blood-bought servant and assigned apostle from God. And in other words, get your dirty, dirty hands of judgment off a property that doesn't belong to you. You understand? It's always in this discerning judging, the deeper thing that I will continue to weave as I go on in Romans 2, that is not just the act of flapping your lip, or it's not just the act of your brain working with evaluative judging ability, it's the presumptions that attach. Starting with the fact, I'm special and I'm better than you and everything revolves around me. No. Paul will go on to say, you may have many teachers, only one father. He laid the foundation of that church at Corinth. They were his assignment from God, and he was God's steward, and they better keep their dirty, dirty, judgmental mouth off of God's servant, as he goes on to say, he that judgeth me is the Lord, using the same word, krino. He that judges me, the Lord. And it doesn't matter what anybody else says, because their judgment doesn't matter to my boss. He and his judgment alone is all that matters. This is my handkerchief. Whether you think I should blow my nose on it or not is none of your business. It's my handkerchief. Now, if I ask you to give me a handkerchief, I assume that you have learned enough, because you're never getting it back. That's just the rules of the house. You're supposed to come here with two handkerchiefs. So you got one left over after. That's the price of sitting up front. You understand that, don't you? Every one of you understand that? Don't go handing me no Kleenex box either. I want a man-sized scraping machine. Now, I can get back to heavy theology now that I've brought us on board. He that judgeth me is the Lord. Furthermore, Paul goes on with wonderful insight about judging. He says, I don't even judge myself. Even though my conscious awareness is, I have no sense. No sense of having failed. Oh, self-righteous. But again, if you take the text out of context, he has defined what the standard of judgment is. Trustworthiness. Faithfulness to a trust. Paul's always talking in the gospel frame of the new covenant, the new relationship that defines righteousness as bathing and righteousness of being able, of trusting God and being able to be trusted by God in your trusting relationship. And when he gives you something as a steward, as Paul was the steward, under-shepherd of the lives of this church, he had no conscious awareness of having failed or fallen short in that stewardship. Indeed, that's what this letter's about. And he's even going to go further and say, I've reasoned with you as you keep reading, and you're going to choose whether I come with love or with a rod, because you are my stewardship, and I don't intend to not do what God has assigned me to do to keep you dumb sheep in line. That was his frame of reference. And he said, I don't have any conscious awareness of having not been faithful. And you know who read the New Testament when he dies. Well, he doesn't die. He thinks he is. At the end of the Timothy letter, where I get the passage for most funerals that I preach, the departure that is a beginning, a ship laden for its journey. I've fought a good fight. I've kept the faith. So he says to these Corinthians, I don't know consciously anywhere that I have not faithfully carried out my stewardship. But I can't rely on that judgment of myself. I rely on the righteous, faithful, loving judgment of God that has promised for my faith His righteousness and life eternal. So Paul puts judging on these eternal things in the right perspective. Don't you judge me. He that judgeth me is the Lord. I don't even judge myself. I can't argue with the Lord if He says I didn't make it. But he's faithful. He will make it. The point I'm making is that this tragedy that has hit America comes when I'm just beginning, as I did on righteousness, and as I did on salvation, and the words of the New Testament, and this brilliant treatise, really, that tells us the whole philosophy of Paul. Corinth, as I've just indicated, he's writing concerning a problem. He's responding to their wrong reaction to his attempt to correct the problem. He's reacting to the fact they think, well, he's out of sight. And he says to them, I'm there. If the Spirit of God is there, and it is, I am the Spirit as Jesus promised her one, and I am there. So don't think just because I'm gone that the Spirit of God cannot reveal to me what's going on in this congregation. I'm coming. And this is my second advanced missile. And if it doesn't straighten you out, I'll come with a rod. Now that wouldn't get too many pastors elected in today's world. And we've forgotten that pastor means shepherd. And then he goes into the next chapter and says, it's come to my attention that you're allowing something in the congregation that even Corinth, sin city of the world, would not allow. And you're not only allowing it, you're puffed up and proud about your tolerance. You are a libertarian to the excess. I judge nobody. I mean, you know, take this concept that I'm just going into and remove the top half of your cranium until if you're hit in the face, I say, send every sinner here in town. But you're going to get a pass before you come in to show you have capacity for respect. You're going to listen when you get here or get thrown out. And if you listen and what I believe is true, faith cometh by hearing and hearing by the word of God, faith is going to happen. And when you start faithing instead of this do this and don't do that kind of religion, God will put his life in you. And I say, you don't have to change to come here, but look out. If you start faithing, God will change you. And he will. And he does. Now, I'm in a hurry. I'm just irritated at the timing. I needed a few more weeks to finish on judgment so I could really unleash both barrels and you'd understand the right of doing so. We'll have to butcher this up a bit. And I'll get back to Romans 2, but I don't want you to think, like some preachers I'm listening to, oh, we dare not. And I hope you're not offended with me using King James terminology. Illegitimate in the King James. Right there staring out at that beautiful type of God's holy word, the inerrant word of God, is their bastards. I'm sick of these preachers saying, we must show them love. We must show them love. All the way to paradise with the fastest route available. Because that's what they want. Be careful. Oh. Judge not. Now, I hope I've said enough. Let me keep going. Paul says, you're letting this person stay. And in your self-styled, prideful Christianity for your own self-image sake, you're letting this jerk live with your father's wife in open incest and be greeted as a brother of the congregation. Judge not, you proudly say, when in Corinth, sin city of the world, Aphrodite headquarters, prostitutes galore, saints to Aphrodite, who gave their body in the temple of Aphrodite in sexual acts, claim to be worship of Aphrodite. In a city where the Playboy Mansion would look like a church, even they, by their law, condemn such incest. That, my friend, Paul said, is license to judge. License to judge the same way Michael judged Satan. The Lord rebuked thee. And Paul says, kick his asteroid out. And I won't even bother with the sixth chapter that condemns those among the brethren who go to law and air their problems in a court of law. And he says, you, the saints, are going to judge the world. Indeed, you're going to judge angels, using the same word, krino. So how dare you, when you're going to judge the world and even judge angels, go and seek in a lesser body, the world, to have your problems adjudicated? Is there no one among you that can be trusted to sit and adjudicate among the saints? The point I'm making is that this open door, I'm just in the first word of the second chapter, first verse. You know how many sermons I've preached on the first chapter, 32 verses? How many? About 120, somewhere around there. Don't think you've got it. I deliberately terrorized you. I wanted you to have, for the first time in your Christian life, a little bit of tension about your natural human trait to judge as naturally as you breathe the air. This habitual judgmental attitude in all cases, it is a weapon to be used, but to be used within God's framework, not mine. And you better be sure that God's against it when you do it. Now, I'm sick and tired of the double standard that's permeating the world today. I'm sick and tired of people saying this is not a religious war. It is. It's a war against an insane religion that no religion of any stature on this earth should tolerate. There are limits on certain religious rights. Cannibals are religious. I have been in northern Luzon while they were still taking heads. They have a religious basis. In some cases, the drinking of blood or the eating of the brains or other vital parts. I remember the horrors. Maui in Central Africa. Some of this church will remember back at King's House 1, even before the days that I came here, when Willard Cantlin preached in the church, having come from that war-torn society. Only religious fanaticism, wrong religious fanaticism, makes the survival instinct of humankind turn into the aberration of religious martyrdom. I've heard newscasters say the kamikaze pilots did that because they became desperate. They need to take a course in comparative religion. The kamikaze pilots attain a religious destiny, in their view, by doing that. If you understand Islam, it is a work of faith, but they have a predestination presupposition underneath that does not give what Christianity gives as much certainty about paradise as the simple act of faith has in Christianity. So the sure bet, you heard it, one Pakistani going back to Afghanistan, leaving his family safe and going back to Afghanistan. If I kill one American, then I have lived. Islam means peace, jihad. Its root is intensity and intense. And holy war is an aberration on Islam, as the Crusades were an aberration on Christianity, and as the Inquisition was an aberration on Catholic evangelism. There are some things that, as society grows, are left off. Cannibal comes from the Babylonian word eating Baal. Kana Baal. Now you don't have to go very far into the languages. Italian, China, Spanish, Sine. Eating is in that root. And it's the basis for what colloquialism says is hocus pocus, hocus corpus meus, and those who believe in transubstantiation at the table of the Lord, that these spoken words by the priest, which comes out of the heathen concept of the oracle, it actually becomes the blood and body of Christ. And the early Christians in the Roman Empire in the first century were accused of being cannibals because of that transubstantiation rite. Cannibals, I repeat, are religious. But it's been discarded by society. Even the Jews no longer offer blood sacrifices except for very fringe groups. And they have had to come to grips with a spiritual way and figurative ways of expressing their devotion to God. And it's really harder for a Jew to do it that way, because Paul translates the meaning of the burnt offering from the barter and trade society of the Old Testament into modern times, where money is the instrument of exchange, and the giving of money to Paul as a preacher is the burnt offering in the book of Philippians, and the sacrifices for the Jews now dips into their pocketbook and comes in the form of pew rent. Pew rent. You rent pews at the synagogue, and you give money, and you show sacrifice in other ways, but they don't have blood running down the steps of the synagogue where the Jew worships, and they never did. They had a temple then. Animal sacrifices have become a thing of history to civilization. Children sacrifices, particularly in this Western society, was a part of religion. Religion of the ignorant, where they would throw their children into the fire or into the river. Society doesn't tolerate that anymore. It doesn't matter whether you're Islam, Christian, Buddhist, or atheist. You don't do some things in the modern world. And you don't entertain. Well, we've got to show religious tolerance and let them throw babies into the fire. No, we don't. Find another way to practice your religion. Even more recently, the persecuted Mormons formed a state. And, of course, there are some in the modern world that just got a problem with their crotch. But I'm here to say, if you know the history of the Mormon religion and their concepts of eternal marriage, and their identity with the Old Testament patriarchs that we never raise a question about. Those Old Testament rites. I mean, if a brother died, you had a duty, if his wife was without child, to another brother, impregnate her to perpetuate the line of inheritance and name. Try to sell that to modern America or modern Europe. Husband dies and the wife is required to let the brother impregnate her. That's an Old Testament practice. Blood revenge. Eye for an eye. Tooth for a tooth. The Old Testament is like the Martins and the Coys. They had to create cities of refuge because the blood slayer that must take vengeance on the one that slew his relative, the manslayer, is running. And if he got inside the city of refuge, had to create cities of refuge to save those that were the object of licensed manslaughter by their law. The Jews have a heritage. If they're going to live by the law, exactly. I don't like the fact that it's only the women. But if a woman is caught in adultery, you don't have any problems of divorce and the companion taking you to the courts. If the woman was caught in adultery, you stoned her to death. You don't have to worry about divorce. She's dead, man. Just go find another one now. And every day you say, remember what happened to my first one. Now, have you seen any stonings recently of women, and is justified these die by stoning? Now, that view still prevails in some Arab countries, some Muslim countries. There's an article in today's Times about an Egyptian that married 203 times. And I thought, how significant. It's the Feast of the Tabernacles. And he had 203 wives. A little skinny guy with a trim little beard, a musician. He had been married 203 times and he's living in a dump. And he says he's got nothing for it because he helped these women. And he was available. And occasionally he'd have a few hours of married life and a few weeks of married life. But prostitutes, for example, have to carry a paper that says they're legitimately married to someone. Read the article. It's very interesting. It's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful gossip. Now he wants to settle down at 70 with two wives that he can live permanently with. But he saved women from stoning. This is a religious war. It's a war that is saying, if you have these alien views that you want to practice, put yourself in a hole in the ground and look at the wall and write in dirt, I will do this and I will do that. But when you come out of your hole and expect us, the rest of the civilized world, to put up with your damnable, archaic, insane, sick, perverse, fringe religion that intelligent Islamic people across the world decry, don't sing a song. Don't sing a song. This is not against religion. It's not against Islam. It's against perverts that have staked a claim falsely, disguised as Islamic people, when they're a pervert fringe, like this idiot in the Corinthian church that came and smiled, and obviously the wife of his father that he was living with was not a member of the church, or Paul would have said, kick her out too. So he is carrying on this incestuous relationship outside the church and coming and smiling. Probably had a deacon board. He'd be on the deacon board judging somebody else for committing fornication. Kick the illegitimate out. I'm telling you, there's nothing non-Christian in being against holy war, jihad, in a modern world that seeks to cram their religion down someone else's throat or eliminate from the face of the earth those who do not embrace their tenet. That is the Crusades in reverse. That is the Inquisition on a large scale. And Christians rise up and curse them to hell and join this nation in a commitment. We will wipe this vermin off the face of the earth, and any country in the name of religion that tries to twist what we're doing, which is seeking out vermin, they should be treated the same way. If you harbor the vermin, you are vermin. Christian radicals that seek to eliminate all who do not share their faith are vermin. It is the 21st century, an interconnected world. I got a doctoral unit minor in comparative religions from Stanford University. I have traveled the Islamic world. I know the five pillars of Islam. I know the distinctions between the Sunni and the Shiite that is based totally upon whether a blood relative should succeed Muhammad the Prophet, which is the stream of the Shiites, or the spiritual leader. I know that we're hearing a lot about the crusade. The crusade was a response to the jihad that brought holy war across North Africa and conquered much of the civilized world. And the crusades were equally evil. There are scars all through history. The Catholic Church committing genocide on the Cathars of the south of France. Religious wars have scarred the world. And for the first time, we have a world that's looking on through television. And the perverts can be distinguished from the sane people of society. This is not an issue of Islam versus Christianity. This is not an issue of America versus Islam. This is an issue of the world against any pervert who seeks to justify through a tag of religion his perversion and thrust it upon the rest of the world. They're isolated. I was glad to read today that most Arab nations are breaking off relationships with the Taliban. Now, listen to me. The reason a preacher is speaking so harshly today, I did my doctoral dissertation on Reinhold Niebuhr. Reinhold Niebuhr, along with Karl Barth in Germany, Emil Brunner, Paul Tillich, were the leading liberal voices prior to the First and Second World War that turned the other cheek Christianity, the all sweetness and roses Christianity, that sin is ignorance and salvation is education, and man is basically good, and given the chance, man will usher in the millennium himself by his goodness. That was the speech of Reinhold Niebuhr at his seminary graduation. He took a church in downtown Detroit of about 100 members and watched it grow to over 1,000 at the same time Ford was turning men into slaves to machines in the Industrial Revolution and flaunting his anti-Semitic viewpoints. And the First and Second World War sprang upon this globe. And the most educated nation in the world. You take just about any area of thought, Germany has made major contributions. And this brilliant, educated nation became the cesspool out of which flowed the worst evils up until now, to strike this globe, including the horrors of the Holocaust. Niebuhr entertained Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the clergymen, leading clergymen of Germany, who escaped the war. Niebuhr gave him a position obtained for him, lectureships in universities in and around the New York area. Smitten in his conscience because he knew that the clergymen of Germany could have stopped Hitler. He went back, smitten in conscience because he had escaped. He went back, too late to be a voice. But out of that trip back, and the imprisonment and ultimate martyrdom, came the little book on discipleship, Cost of Discipleship, that has transformed lives around the world who've read it. But from these experiences, Niebuhr, who influenced Kennedy, Kissinger, one of the common grounds of discussion that Henry Kissinger and I off-camera spent a lot of time on during the library telethon was the influence of Reinhold Niebuhr on this country. And he was an advisor in statesmanship. He wrote, "The irony of American history is that we're like a teenager with big muscles and have the power, but don't have the experience in statesmanship." And with an incisive scalpel, he provided guidance that just about every single Secretary of State and leading person in American policy has drawn from. And he is the one who coined the phrase, or made it a catchword phrase, tragic choice. As he analyzed the clergyman of Germany, who wouldn't judge. I'm frustrated again that I'm not finished with the unraveling of the full meaning of Romans 2. They wouldn't judge. War is unthinkable. Christians don't go to war. "Thou shalt not kill" produced the ridiculousness of the conscientious objector who makes the guns and doesn't pull the trigger. This impractical assertion of Christian ideals with a perfectionist expectation. That's why the law had to be replaced with trust. "Thou shalt not kill." Jesus was not really expecting a performance when he said, "You've heard it said unto you, thou shalt not kill. But behold, I say unto you, if you hate in your heart, you're guilty already." He was trying to teach him, nobody can live up to that standard. Quit trying to say, because I made the gun and shipped it and they pulled the trigger, I didn't kill. Yes, you did. When you bought a war bond, you did. When you worked in a defense factory, you did. We're caught in that bind. And God knew it. The devil said to Eve, "Eat of this tree, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and you'll be like God." And as Paul understood, the law was given as a schoolmaster to teach us, we can't do it. I'll eventually get to Romans 7 that ends, "Who shall deliver me from the body of this death?" and to the victory of Romans 8. We got a lot of messages in between. You can't do it. You're caught in the bind and tension down here. And God in His grace and love has covered us and forgiven us for our shortfallings and given us another path of trust. Something I can do, I can trust Him. And he analyzed the clergyman in Germany who abhorred war. Christians can't go to war. And they thought, as from their pulpits, they had enough power to stop Hitler before he reached the unstoppable stage. They thought the choice was like a lot of preachers you're listening to today. So they taught their congregations, you can't go to war. Pacifism, love. Pacifism, love. And they did that until Hitler was at such a stage he could annihilate them. Their error was, they thought the choice was war or peace. That was not the choice. The choice was submission to tyranny or war against it. And that posed, in Reinhold Niebuhr's words, a tragic choice. Now, it's amazing how common sense departs on matters of theology. We make tragic choices in life all the time. You buy this instead of that because you can't have it both ways. You hit sacrifice flies instead of trying to hit a home run. That's a tragic choice that's made to put you in a position to win the game. A tragic choice is not an evil choice. It's a choice that incorporates the inevitability of the evil in the mix. And it's tragic because you have no choice that avoids evil in the mix. That's the tragedy. But it's a tragic choice rather than an evil choice because you choose the lesser of the evil that lets you progress to the ideal. Submission to tyranny removes the opportunity of democracy. War is one of the most undemocratic institutions. You submit to war rather than tyranny because war can remove the tyranny and you can return to democracy. A dangerous, tension-filled decision. Idealist philosophers that never get out in the stream of life will say, end justifies the means. No. You never paint the black gray. You never stop seeing how awful war is. But submission to tyranny is more awful. You never stop seeing how terrible the price to root out these insane terrorists. But how much more awful to leave our future in the hands of this terror. It's a tragic choice. A tragic choice. That going after the terrorists, and I'm not so prissy that I mind. I admire Bush's Texas terminology. Dead or alive, wanted dead or alive. Smoke them out of their holes, run them down. You know, I never thought that I would be able to say when Saturday Night Live was on parroting Bush, boy, they had it right, don't mess with Texas. I'm really glad. He's won me over, I'll tell you that. These intellectuals and these philosophers, and now they got, 10-year-old kids on TV telling us what we should do. Well, it takes one to know one, and they're... Tragic choices are part of life. That's what tough love's about in your home. The choice between loving to be loved or loving. The tragic choice between respect and love. Oh, love's pleasant. Getting respect, price, sometimes beyond belief. Without respect, love will go. So give me trust rather than love. Because without respect, the love's going to go. And respect with love is the ideal. And vice versa. Tension of tragic choices that determine your behavior day in and day out. That's what we face right now. We don't have a choice. We don't have a choice to turn the other cheek. Oh, I hear, win them over with love. The Muslims themselves can't win them over with love. They are fanatical idiots using the name of Allah to further their hunger for power and a sick attitude of what gets them into eternity. They're sick. And they are bubonic plague. Will understand Islam. Fine. Islam step forward and condemn jihad forever, forever, forever. It doesn't exist in today's world anymore. television, and they're hearing me in the Middle East right now. Yeah. I condemn crusades as unchristian forever, forever, as unreligious forever, forever, in any sane way. It's not anything that can be done in the name of God. I condemn the Inquisition. I condemn forced conversions. I put it in the category of headhunting and stoning women. Now, don't cry on my shoulder. Unless you are willing to do what Paul told that Corinthian church to do. Eject these jihad idiots from Islamic faith. I then will know that Islam deserves a respected place in the world religions, that his numbers, that the numerical quantity indicates. There's no place in this world today for holy wars. There's no place in this world today for holy wars in the name of any faith, be it Christian, Islam, or any fanatical fringe. There's no place for it. That is not acceptable religion in today's world anymore than first century Christianity would be allowed in today's world to embrace Ignatius, who denied the attempts of Christians to keep him from his martyrdom in Rome because he wanted a martyr's crown. That's a sickness that has no place in today's religion. And one last thought. Reinhold Niebuhr also saw this. Christian ethics, love, is between you and God, and one-on-one between you and other Christians. Period. As I said on Festival, I understand the command of Jesus, which really was designed to show how hypocritical and impossible the legal way was. He said, if they ask you for your coat, give them your cloak also. If they bomb the Trade Center, give them a plane and show them where the tower in Chicago is. Turn the other cheek. If they ask for my coat, give them a cloak. Now that doesn't, again, dig deep to the real meaning. Am I giving them the cloak because you're watching and I want you to think I'm a good Christian? You know what I'm saying? But now let's assume you give me your coat. You're a handsome man without it. Now, this you will get back. It's not like a handkerchief. Now, you come and I get a chance to show off how Christian I am. Come here, Gil. Run up those stairs and don't fall. Give me your coat. No, you say it to me.
Oh, give me your coat.
And I give you this one, but you take too long because I'm watching the clock. And I say, here, take my cloak too.
Thank you,
sir. Now, take it over here. Give it back to him. Now, ain't I generous? I'm obeying the rule. They ask you for your coat, give them your cloak also. In my case, I got his cloak.
given away, and I still got mine. But in improving my spiritual image, I stole his coat. I breached fiduciary duty. I betrayed trust. I became a thief. And my stewardship sucks. He trusted me. He trusted me. He trusted me. And to personally apply my religious fanaticism and make myself look like a super spiritual person, I betrayed his trust. That's why Reinhold Niebuhr, in talking about the irony of American history in his other books, and the fallacy of America, in thinking that Christian principles could be applied on a national scale, President Bush, his staff, and the Congress are trustees with a responsibility. We have given them our cloak of protecting our way of life and protecting the things that we have entrusted them to be in charge of. And what kind of idiocy, Reinhold Niebuhr would say, for a statesman to stand up there and to get some fanatical Big Adam's apple and double chin preacher down in the South, or some blockhead that looks like a tank that has obviously eaten out all that the McDonald's restaurants have in town, or some other little freak sitting there with a bubble-headed rubber blonde from some porno shop sitting next to him that talks. Telling my president to give my life and my livelihood and my future and our people's rights to some fanatical idiot pervert off the edge of Islam and turn the other cheek. He's given my life away, not his. Ah, whoa! Whoa! The norm for national stewardship is justice and right, not love. I don't want the officials of this nation, nor should you want, nor should you measure them. That's why I said, shut up, preachers. Don't apply the individual rule of love to these trustees of national life and treasures. They will be judged by God for their stewardship, not for their giveaway loving relationship to the enemy. Stewardship. Justice is the norm. And they have to make the tragic choices to choose the path of eradicating this evil that's a threat to all of us. That once eradicated, we can return to the norm. Violence begets violence. Uh-huh. But it eliminated the Kaiser and it eliminated Hitler. And God be praised. Though the Lord allow the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not thy teachers be removed. Thine eyes shall see thy teachers, and thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it. I'm your teacher, and this is the way, walk ye in it. And that's my message. Today or next Sunday. Ed was tested in the song he sang. Inoperable cancer. Pray for him. I'm going to have him sing it today to himself as well as us and to the world. My God can do anything. Good day, folks.